relatively similar to two-way paging, because you could both send and receive SMS. Now, if the phone was not turned on, the message gets held at the messaging center until you connect, and when you register again, then it sends the message to you. The message is a relatively small, 140 octets, so 160 USM characters, but you can concatenate multiple messages together, and you can even do compression of the messages and decompression. Now, what's interesting to me is that with the international roaming, the messages can be delivered in any GSM network, no matter where you are. The result of this is there are a number of companies, particularly in Switzerland and South Africa, that are GSM SMS operators. Their major purpose for existence is people buy bulk SMS service from them, you send them SMSs, and they have negotiated deals to send these out into other networks, because it looks like they're sending SMS. There are two types of messages, self-broadcast and point-to-point service. Tremendous amount of the activity today is in point-to-point service, but self-broadcast is rather interesting. So one of my former students in Singapore said during the time whenever they were having this problem about disease infecting lungs, that they use the SMS cell broadcast facility to actually send messages out in areas that were infected, telling people where to go to get treatment. Which is rather clever, because if you do the cell broadcast, it goes to all terminals that are in that cell. Now, fascinating thing is SMSs aren't necessarily messages to the user at the terminal. You can actually send SMSs to the device itself, to display a particular ringtone, display a business card, change the default icon so it tells you, hey, this is the network you're visiting in, and all sorts of things like that. You can even send SMSs to the SIM card. Yes, just think of the advantages of that, right? So here's this programmable device inside the user's phone, and you can send it messages. It can even send messages, all without the user knowing. And so with the SIM toolkit, you can actually go and, via SMS, send messages to update the user's cards to do things like change the balance in their prepaid cards, presumably by increasing their balance. But they're just messages. Yes. The architecture of the SMS system is rather interesting because, not surprisingly, it has a database. You have this SMSC, the Short Message Service Center, and it connects to a gateway. It connects to the SGSN, to the MSC, etc. So you can both send this packet data in this way, and it can, of course, receive data through this path, and it delivers it out to the phone. Very straightforward architecture. Now, these SMSCs have to have very high reliability, right? Because they're responsible for delivering all of the messages. And a number of companies have tried very, very, very hard to build high-performance SMSCs. Every SMS has to be charged for, and the call data records can be very big. So management at one point had call data records as high as 2,500 to 3,000 call data records per second being generated because of users in their network sending SMSs. As I mentioned yesterday, this became a big problem, and for reasons I don't quite understand, it's largely Germany, that the call data record volumes were so high it became a problem just to keep all the call data records. Let alone the fact that each of the SMSCs is having to compute and do database entries to decide, is the user here? Shall I send the message? Shall I not send the message? Shall I store the message? Oh, the user's reappeared. Okay, now pull the messages out that you saved for the user, etc. A couple of years ago, I had a master's student who did his thesis on MMSC, the multimedia messages. And his X job all revolved around the problems of high performance. because the company wanted to make sure that at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, that people who wanted to send their SMSs and MMS would be happy because they would get sent. So the whole system specification revolved around a 5-minute window that occurred mostly once a year. Yes. And dimensioning the system to support that was important for the customer. And he got in quite a lot of trouble because his measurements showed it didn't actually support the rate that it said it would. And, of course, the company didn't want to buy it in the middle of the summer. And then finally, come December, whoops, it doesn't work. I mentioned that. Entering short messages, of course, you can do it by the keyboard. There are plug-in chat keyboards if you're really into this sort of thing. On-screen keyboards. And even predictive typing. So things like P9, etc. Handwriting recognition, particularly for Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, and even in some cases, speech recognition. So some of you may have seen there's a Swedish company that started up called something like Voiceify, I think. And the company's business is basically taking voice messages, relatively short amounts of voice, I forget, 20, 30 seconds, and automatically doing speech recognition to turn them into a text message. An interesting service. And then, of course, there are all the various shorthands that you can use, and if you care, you can look at it. Now, one of the problems is that if the users enter these SMSs via their mobile device, that's pretty straightforward. But the large bulk of SMSs are actually produced by other computers and generated and sent to the SMSC by something called the external application interface. The hard problem, however, is although they all talk over TCP/IP, they're all proprietary protocols. And there are three of them. And so depending on which SMSC you want to talk to, you have to talk three different protocols. And that's caused a lot of problems in terms of people being able to easily send large numbers of SMSs. But more people seem to be going to the short message peer-to-peer protocol. It has nice clean specification, and there's a group promoting it. But these two ones are widely used, both Nokia and Vodafone systems. So as I mentioned, you can go and read about the thesis about the performance. But the thing that most people are really interested in is what's the cumulative distribution function, right? At some point, it starts low, a small fraction of them are delivered very fast, and it keeps increasing. More than 1 minute of time to deliver 90% of the messages, with several minutes being the case out here in the tail. And that's caused a lot of problems for SMS, because it tries, as I said yesterday, to be used for entertainment systems, but if it takes a minute to be able to deliver a message, and that's each way, the service has got a problem. There's also voice messaging. You can have voice mailboxes. You can have voicemail alerts that get sent to you by SMS when voicemail arrives, etc. There's even a voicemail profile. So if your mail arrives at the operator's voicemail center, it can digitize the mail, form it into an email message, and mail it to you as email. And there's a defined voice profile that is how you encapsulate voice messages as regular email. And not surprisingly then, you can use IMAP to download it to a player on whatever computer you happen to be running on. There's also an enhanced messaging service that lets you put in graphics, icons, sounds, all sorts of things. And this basically builds on the fact that you can chain several SMSs together, so you can actually deliver pictures if you want. I mentioned a moment ago the multimedia system, and here the goal is rather interesting. They wanted to be able to deliver synchronized multimedia presentations, so both pictures and sound, and you could have a whole sequence of pictures played times to go with the sound that you want there. By using something called SMILE, the Synchronized Multimedia Integration Language. But a hard problem about this service is, while it's a logical extension of the SMSC, so of short messages will make the messages bigger and make them multimedia, there's sort of a problem, and that is that they're big. And so rather than deliver them over the control channel, that wasn't going to work, right? Because SMS already had a problem with that. So the solution was, in fact, to force the user by sending them a notification saying, basically, you have a new multimedia message. Go and get it. And so now when the user chooses to go and get it, they open a traffic channel, or using GPRS, establish a TCP connection, download it to the terminal, or to an internet-attached host, and voila, they have the multimedia message. Now, the problem about this is, if you think about it, okay, I have my MMS-equipped phone, I take my picture, I say whatever the voice greeting is, I send a picture off to one of my friends. Sounds really good, right? I send by the MMS service, and the difficulty is, as an operator, the operator looks at that and says, wow, golden opportunity, right? Charge the customer a lot of money for providing the service. If I take the same picture, make the same voice annotation, put it in an email, and then use SMTP to deliver it to my friend's email server, it costs me about 1/100th of the price that I have to pay for MMS. Right? My friend still gets the same mail message, or same message, with picture and audio, but it was much cheaper. So why was MMS successful, or relatively successful, in attracting customers who used it? Any hint? Well, yes. That's right. The user didn't have to do anything. The handset was already configured to make it easy to do MMSs. It wasn't configured to make it easy to take your picture, take the audio, put them together, send them an email, etc. It was customer convenience. Okay. And part of the problem is that this system was engineered for the operators, not for the customers. Right? It was designed to be able to produce high revenues for the operator for customers sending these messages. And it was made to be really simple for the customer to use because it supported user profiles, subscription, all sorts of things like that. But you paid a high price for that. So it had a high premium. As we mentioned yesterday, there was a problem because SMS was using the control channel. Subsequently, with the introduction of GPRS, SMS could be sent over GPRS, and voila, the problem disappeared. And, as I mentioned, you could think about doing all these messaging applications just using email. But what's the problem if you were to simply run email on your smartphone? The what?
The receiver.
No, because in fact you can get email clients that will happily run on your smartphone.
But
that's not the problem.
But the revenue of the operators will decrease.
Yeah, the revenue of the operators decreases. But if it, although that sounds like, well, that's not so bad if I'm the user, there is a bad problem for the user. Yeah.
Synchronization.
Yeah. The enormous problem for the user is to synchronize with your mail server. What do you have to do? You have to connect to your mail server and check to see whether there's any mail. Right? Now, most of the time, is there mail? Right. No. So you turn on the radio, you power up, you connect, and you find out, no, there's no new mail for me. You shut down, you wait a while, you do all of that again, and whoops, there's no mail for you. Shut down again. So there were two students who did a master's thesis project a couple years ago who looked at the problem of the fact that you were just burning through your batteries at an incredible rate, most of the time checking and finding there was no mail. And they said, could we do something about this? And I leave it to you to go and read the thesis if you want, but the interesting point was, yes, you can actually manage to decrease the battery consumption by being smarter about how you check it on mail and batching messages together rather than handling them one by one. Because you can use some other signaling to give you a hint of whether you should get your mail or not. So the synchronization problem is a very big problem. Now, why is synchronization a problem? Well, another difficulty is the fact that you might have multiple terminals. Right? There's nothing that stops you from owning several devices. And a big problem is how do you synchronize even the configuration of your devices, right? So I add a new user to my list of contacts in this device, and then I pick up my other phone, and what do I expect? Well, I'd like the same thing that I already put in. I don't want to have to put the contact information in twice. Or I got the email message over here, and now I'm using this device. And I said, well, where's that email message? Well, it's in this other device. Oops, too bad. So actually, one of my doctoral students, Ross Litho, a couple of years ago, looked at the problem of how do you actually manage to update all of your devices and keep them consistent, both in content but also in their profile. It turns out it's not as simple a job as you might imagine. Another area that's not quite as simple as you might imagine is international roaming. We said GSM was designed so that any GSM system that you went to, if you had an operator who had a roaming agreement with the visitor's network, you would get service. But this requires lots of agreements with individual operators. And as some of you might have heard, there was a talk on Monday afternoon, actually four talks that Wireless Exchange Gates did, and one of them was given by Professor Law from the University of Amsterdam. And he was very clear on the fact that one of the best parts about telecom was the fact that it generated lots of income for lawyers, because every one of these agreements had to be negotiated with lawyers involved. And of course, one for each side. So that is sort of a full employment act for lawyers. The good news was it worked. They could negotiate the agreement. The bad news is that it could be extremely expensive to run. And a worse problem is the fact of this so-called tromboning. So if you're not at home and somebody calls you, as we said yesterday, that can result in two international calls. One from where they are to Sweden, and one from Sweden back to you. And you paid for the other one because you weren't in your home network. And you might both even be in the same city, or even in the same building, and this would still happen. Now, some of you may know the new minister, or he's been minister for some time now in Europe, for communication, has said that, no, we have to drive down the cost of roaming. Does anyone know the subtle thing she didn't say? The EU move to lower roaming charges only applies to voice. So for those of you who are addicted to data access when you're roaming, be very careful because you could end up with an enormously big bill. Because that wasn't considered in part of this lowering the cost of roaming.
It will be considered for this one, I guess.
Yes. But it's been a very, very big shock to people who mentally thought, aha, the cost of roaming have gone down. And then they arrive back home and find a 7,000 euro bill for their recent trip because, gee, I use the data access just like I would at home. Where I thought, gee, it's only 299 kroner a month, unlimited, or something like that. Oops. Now, these two students, Hanan Shazad and Mishos Jain, did a wonderful master's thesis showing how using internet protocol, you could build an IP backbone to provide GSM roaming. And they did this for ships. And the neat thing is the fact that they use IP to pass all of the signaling information back to your home network. But they actually send all of the voice calls directly between the two terminals on board. So the result is, although you have tromboning for the signaling, you don't have tromboning for the actual voice traffic itself, which is very, very clever. And someone asked me yesterday, well, why do the home operators allow this? And the answer is, of course, that for people out on ships, they wouldn't make any revenue on these customers because they don't have any network coverage for them. So this way they make a little bit of money, and someone else makes a bunch of money, but they're making some money. Okay, enhanced data rates for GSM Evolution Edge. Someone basically realized that, hey, we have all of this data traffic, and data traffic was growing in the network, and people wanted higher data rates, higher speeds, lower prices, et cetera. And they said, okay, it's a time-slotted network. If we just change the coding that we do for GPS in the time slot, we can give it a faster rate. And that's all that Edge does. This was extremely important because the traditional GSM operators were starting to worry about new people with 3G licenses being able to offer high-speed data. And if they were stuck at 171 kilobits per second, oops, they would lose customers. However, GSM Edge, just like 3G, said, well, actually, in data customers, we've got different classes of customers. Because we've had customers who really want very low delays, but we have some customers who really don't care about delays. They just want low cost, high throughput, doing bulk FTP file transfers, for instance. And then there are a set of classes of interactive and streaming. And so a huge amount of effort today has gone into trying to deal with the QoS profile. Now the hard problem for GPRS is that GPRS, if you have, for instance, a file transfer going on while you also have interactive voice or video sessions, it treats those as two different GPRS sessions. Because that is the only way they could keep a separate profile for each of them. Yes, you have to do twice the setup, twice the signaling, and so forth to be able to support that, because it actually supports them in two different so-called PDP, protocol data contexts. They seem to have forgotten that IP was a networking protocol. And if you could have simply distinguished this by using the IP headers. Now this is even more a problem because it turns out in GPRS, those GGSMs we talked about yesterday, the gateway GPRS supporting nodes, in most cases are not only routers, they're also network address translators. Now why is that a problem? Okay, think of have your mobile device, GPRS capable, and you're communicating with this other person attached to the internet over here, and there's a NAT in the way. What's the problem? You can call them, but they can't call you. Right? Because inside the operator's network, you have a private IP address, not a public IP address. It only gets a public IP address when it gets to this GGSN, because that's the gateway to the public internet. Okay? Everyone understand that?
Yes.
Well, the key problem is if the person over here doesn't know an address to be able to send things to you when it gets the NAT soup, it doesn't get inside the network. So Gustav Soderstrom, who did another X job, got an interesting assignment for Telia Research. They said, we want you to look at services between users in two different operators' networks And we want you to tell us what are the limitations that a peer-to-peer service would have, because they started to get nervous about this, such that we would have to basically offer new functions in the gateway to allow these services, and therefore the operator could control them. And Gustav went off and said, okay, how can we do this? And the answer, of course, you introduce another node, but you attach it to the internet. From inside, what you do is you send it a message. And now, it learns your inside address mapping, it learns what your public IP address is, and now if someone wants to communicate with you, they simply go to your proxy. Right? And they rendezvous with the proxy, and now they learn what your current IP address is, and now you can happily communicate from outside to in. The result is he shows a chat service at 1/1000th of the price that Telly was then charging for their messaging service. And he showed streaming video running between two terminals for 1/100th the price that they were then proposing for their media service. And they said, of course, yes, thank you very much. Please sign the patent agreement here and go away. Right, and preferably don't tell anyone. But he went off and started another company, or started a company, called Connect Network. And then it was subsequently bought for a large sum of money by Yahoo. And I was very pleased to see just the other day that he left Yahoo. I wasn't pleased to see he left Yahoo, but I was pleased to see that he left Yahoo to become the chief technologist at a new company, Spotify. But I think the importance of this was not that, yes, he became rich, famous, and happy. Those don't necessarily all match together, but it helps. But, then he said, it isn't simply a technical problem. There's a technical solution to it, and therefore we can eliminate the technical problem of the NAT at the GCSS. And suddenly, we can have peer-to-peer services between users, even in different operators' networks. So there isn't a problem there, although the operators might like there's a problem there. The problem, however, is what you learn is the address of one of those PDP contacts. So for one class, now what you can do is, of course, if that's the bulk class, you can just send a few messages every few minutes between your node and this outside node, and it keeps the NAT connect whole, basically in the firewall open, because you keep that address. And he found that it only at that time cost about 50 kronas per month to be able to essentially hold down your IP address. But the problem is you can do that only for one of the addresses, for one of your classes. And if you wanted to have the other classes, then you'd have to spend a whole lot of money just to keep the NAT happy. We mentioned operation, administration, and maintenance, and it does a whole bunch of things, but one of the most important is dealing with network management. And if you can actually manage to read all of these things and understand what two adapters are, etc., then you've really learned ITUT, the International Telecommunications Union Telecom Section, speak. But as they say, you have to talk the talk to walk the walk. So if you're going to work in this area and deal with ITU standards, you need to be able to start understanding these terms like network equipment functions, as I say, two adapters, etc., etc. This is all very, very classical telecom. But a very, very important part of operators actually making money, keeping their networks working. And for further details, of course, it should go to the network management classes that Rolf Stadler has. And then you can read lots more about these. For those of you who read French, Willie and Paulette have a new book, it's the definitive book on GSM. Unfortunately, as far as I know, it's still only in French. The original version of this was also only in French. And they managed to take these many shelf meters of the specifications and actually turn it into a book about that thing. And it's reasonably readable. Now we'll talk a little bit about number portability, voice, prepaid, and location-based services. Number portability, as we said, was important to encourage users to be able to switch from one operator to another, and therefore promoting competition between the operators. And local number portability was first required in 1996 in the United States by the FCC, and then spread to many other places. One of the fascinating things was the fact that this order came about because of an observation in the state of Illinois, when the local regulating committee said, okay, you have these free phone numbers, things like 020 here in Sweden, and to deliver that call, you have to do a database lookup to decide where to deliver that call, because it's, the prefix doesn't tell you which exchange it goes to. And they said, basically said, well, what percentage of calls are these non-geographic numbers? And the local telephone, major telephone operator, the former incumbent, said, well, 50%. They said, 50%? You can already do lookups for 50%. Well, why don't you just do lookups for the other 50%? And then you can have number portability, right? Because all I have to do to shift it from one operator to another is simply say, look it up, find out who is the current operator that it should be directed to. And that was a very important change. And suddenly everybody said, well, we have to have local number portability and mobile number portability. Now Verizon's approach to this was to say, well, if you want to have number portability, somebody has to pay for that database. So they decided they would increase the customer's bill by $13.80 per line for 5 years, where Denmark said, hey, all right, the donor operator, the network that had the phone number, charges the recipient operator, the number, the operator you move to, 72 Danish kroner, about €9.60, excluding that. So one time fee. Now, why were they able to do this for such a low price in comparison to this times five? Because they wanted this to happen. Verizon didn't want customers to actually move. They were just being forced to do it. Here the advantage was Denmark was actually saying, well, if I'm a recipient operator, yes, I'm going to get money. And who am I going to take money away from? Well, the company nowadays known as TDC, right? Because they were the incumbent. They were only going to lose customers. And so, of course, all of those people supported in the government saying, yes, yes, this is a great idea. Please introduce this one-time fee. So as we mentioned yesterday, it's sometimes the politics, economics, et cetera, the rules, not just the technology. So there are three kinds of number portability. We can have service provider portability. That means the subscriber gets to move from one network to the other. We can have location or geographic portability. So the subscriber moves to a new location or geographic area. And we can have service portability. And this is one of the hardest, because to implement this last says that all of the services I used to have in my previous operator's network have to be available to me when I move to the new operator. And that may be very difficult if my operator provides very specific services that I really like. And so far, none of the jurisdictions require service portability. They say, hey, if you like those operator services, then you better stick with that operator. But it's going to become an interesting question in the future. Will this become required? But the first two have either been required or are on the way to being required. Mobile number portability as we said yesterday, meant that I could switch to a new operator, a new service provider, but yet I just keep my same phone number. And it was predicated on the non-geographic number portability. It's all database lookup. But one problem becomes, which databases and when do I look in them? So, if the donor, in this case, the service provider from whom the number is originally associated with, does call forwarding at the donor end, that means it calls originated here, goes through various transit networks, and of course it goes to the donor network, because all the indications are that's who the phone number belongs to. The donor looks in their database, and they forward on to the recipient network. It's really inefficient, because of course everything has to go through the donor's network. It doesn't deal with numbers that are forwarded more than once, because now if the user moves from here to yet another network, it'll first go here, then to the next one, and you keep getting this chain every time you change operators. And the donor network continues to control all of the subsequent forwarding. If we want to chop out the second tab, then we have to update them again back at the donor network. There's so-called drop-back forwarding. In this case, the transit network asks the donor network, hey, is this really for you? And the donor network simply says, no, it's not. Here's the network it should go to. And this greatly improves things because the call setup is actually having to go through the network this way. Better use of transmission capacity and handles multiple forwarding because now we just update this and simply redirect it. And we can immediately redirect it. However, the donor continues to be responsible for all subsequent forwarding. There's a so-called query on release approach. Here, we actually cache information in the transit network. And so now we only have to worry if the mapping changes. So now the call comes along, the transit network says, hey, I know where that is to go and sends it directly on to where it's going. Now, we can think about instead lookup approaches where now we just have a portability database and the transit network looks and says, hey, that number has been ported, I know where it's ported to and I deliver it there. Now, of course, the donor network has no role because all of the smarts are the content of the database. However, it requires looking up all numbers, because you have no idea which numbers have been ported. There are various two-stage solutions to this. You actually look in the database and the originating network, and you figure out what network it goes to. They look in their database, and they figure out where to forward it to. And the solution which actually Sweden requires is the all-call, all-network solution. It says every network does its own lookup, and learns the next network address. And it keeps doing that until finally it gets to the recipient network. So obviously the question is, who knows all of these mappings so that you know what to put in the databases? And for North America, it's the Number Portability Center. And they subcontracted this to a company called Neustad. In Sweden, it's the Swedish Number Portability Administrative Center. And they know all of the mappings. And you can read Swedish standards for this. And one of the interesting things is the Swedish number portability standard is owned by all the operators. So if you're an operator, one of the things you have to do is you have to pay your share of running this portability center. And they can split the cost based upon the number of subscribers in the network. A rather clever model. Yes?
Why don't they just switch to something like
DNS? Well, the problem is that somebody has to be responsible for putting things in the DNS. Right? So you have the DNS servers themselves.
Yeah, that's the one that, if you are signing the contract,
then
the company is responsible for updating my DNS. Because, but that's effectively what this
does. Right? Yeah, it creates a distributed database.
This is a proprietary system, you know, with some fancy protocols and DNS already there.
Oh, the problem. That's a separate problem. First is the problem about administratively managing the portability database. The second problem is about the protocols to talk to this database. Right? And we actually haven't said anything yet about the protocols to talk to it. And one of the interesting things is that in the case of Sweden, and you can read about it in the Swedish regulation, unfortunately all in Swedish, it simply is about the database. It doesn't say what the protocols are to the database, and in fact, all they do is simply build a distributed database. So they use standard distributed database protocols to do this. Why? Because the actual lookup in the database to map numbers at the time of the call, that's up to the equipment already that the operator has. Right? So this is rather interesting because it says we get the portability, we get the advantages of like DNS, but everybody has their own copy of the database. All they do is get updates. Well, you can think of them as like RSS feeds. There's been a change in this number. Here's the new updated information in the database. You update the database that you keep. So every operator is keeping a copy or portion of a copy of this database. Now, for those of you who are really interested in this sort of thing, there's a wonderful paper by a professor now at Cambridge, used to be at University College London, who's written a very excellent paper saying, well, what would actually happen if you converted DNS to this model? To simply say that instead of using the current DNS approach, we simply took a distributed database approach. And the paper is very nice because it actually goes into details of how many lookups there are and what are the advantages of having this distributed database. Okay. So what's one of the weaknesses today in the DNS system? Right? DNS poisoning. Right? It's easy to fake entries and poison a DNS cache, and everyone who then gets their ID of the current mapping from that DNS cache gets the wrong address. But if you actually do it as a distributed database, you can actually have signed database records and signed updates that are signed by this trusted sender, and you say, okay, yes, I put it in my database, and now it's a separate operator problem about protecting the integrity of that database, rather than I pollute some cache out here who I don't know or have control over, and then suddenly all the traffic that should be coming to my customers is going somewhere else. So I actually think we're going to go the other direction, is not towards DNS, but really towards database-like solutions to this.
But there's DNSSEC for securing DNS.
Yes, and DNSSEC has been around for some time, and how many entities use DNSSEC?
Not so many. Yes.
Right, but does anyone know what country is one of the biggest DNSSEC users? It's Sweden. So Sweden was an earlier adopter of DNSSEC and has been very aggressively pushing it. And I think DNSSEC is another move, again, in the direction of treating it as database updates, and now they're simply signed. But anyhow, it's an interesting area. The EU has this document, and you can go and read about the regulations in terms of operator number portability and user pre-selection. There is not yet a decision about portability between countries. It's only a decision about portability within countries. But I think it will not be long before we have a regulation in the EU that says you must have portability between countries. Because we have rules in terms of personal mobility. You should be able to move from one of the countries to another without hindrance. But if I have to give up my phone number, that's a problem. If I don't give up my phone number, then I have a problem about roaming. So either we're going to see roaming charges basically drop to near zero, or we're going to have number portability. Now, to give you an idea of how big a problem this is to do this portability, Nortel is the company that has a system that they have designed for doing this global title translation. They did, as of a couple of years ago, support 5,000 queries per second, and they expected to go up to 20,000 queries per second. what does this mean if you're in a country that has an all-call lookup requirement?
Yeah.
It tells you this is the maximum number of new calls that can be originated per second, because you have to do a lookup for every one. That's a pretty small number. If we think 3-minute business calls, we can multiply it up and figure out what's the maximum busy call hour attempt at setting up calls. So not surprisingly, other people said, well, we can build a really fast engine for that. And so there's this company, Aeroflex, that built a system to handle 160 million 16-digit phone numbers and support 100,000 lookups per second with 10,000 updates per second. You compare 100,000 with 5,000, you see these people are thinking in the right direction, right? If you're going to do lots and lots of lookups, you better be able to do large numbers of them fast. Now, to do this, they actually had to build their own ASIC to support this, and basically it's just a very, very, very large, giant in-core table with parallel searches. All that clear to everybody? Yes? No? Okay. So we'll take a break until 9 o'clock, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about voice over IP, and then move on from there. So.